It turns out that motion is everywhere. It's inevitable as the sunrise and incontrovertible as life itself. Motion is the default state of all matter. From the tiniest electrons orbiting their atoms to galaxies so large it boggles the mind, spinning around each other, locked in a kind of cosmic dance, motion is everywhere. And the strange thing, at least to me, is that the universe doesn't ask us or invite us to come along for the ride. It moves on its own volition, faster than you can possibly imagine. From a physical standpoint, it might take a year for the Earth to revolve around the sun, but the sun, it's at the same time, is taking a 225 million year journey around the galaxy, meaning that even if you lived 100 lifetimes, you would never physically be in the same place twice. From a biological standpoint, most of the 75 trillion cells that make up your body die and are remade every 7 to 10 years, meaning that you are a completely different person than you were a decade ago. Psychologically, every interaction that you have and every conversation that you overhear works in slow and steady ways to rewire the neural pathways of your brain, ensuring that every decision you make is made anew. And yet, even with a brand new body, in a place you've never been before and will never be again, and with a brand new consciousness, we dig in our heels and stubbornly refuse to accept the motions of the universe. Galatians is a letter about that movement. Written in about the year 60 CE, it was written into a context where Jewish nationalism was the hot topic of the day. It was on all of the political minds. Rebellion was about to break out in the city of Jerusalem, and there was a drive to make Judaism more ethnically pure. Christianity enjoyed at this time the protection of being under the umbrella of Judaism. It was part of the Jewish sect, the Jewish way of understanding God and the world according to the Roman Empire. And if Christians were going to benefit from being considered Jews by the Romans, then Christians were going to have to make themselves more Jewish. Paul wrote this letter to remind the churches in Galatia and to remind the church today that what Christ had done for them, through them, with them, and in them was itself changing creation. And there is no going back. Movement is inevitable. We don't get a say in whether or not we're moving. But what we do get a say in, Paul tells us, is where we move and how. His plea for the church in Galatia, and I think that his plea for every person in this room today would be this and only this. If you have to move, and you do, move forward together. Paul wants to make this point as clear as possible, and so he says in the letter itself, see what large letters I write this with. Paul's caps lock is on, because Paul wants to grab the attention of any casual glancers who might be perusing the New Testament at the time, who might pick up the letter of Galatians and miss everything else. He wants to ensure that they stop at this point and hear this message loud and clear. Move forward. And move forward together. The first half of Paul's conclusion is the definitive rejection of the idea that motion is somehow a choice. The entire letter of Galatians represents for the church a conversation, because throughout the letter, Paul is single-minded in his devotion to clarifying this one topic and exemplifying why it matters as much as Paul seems to think it does. The heart of the Galatian gospel is that the cross has to be enough. To add anything, to add any requirement and say, this is necessary to save, this is necessary to reconcile you to God, this action or that action is to imply that what Jesus did, the price that God himself paid in hanging on the cross for you, was simply not enough to bring you to him. Think about that for a second. God gives everything to bring people to God, and people turn around and say to God, what you did is simply not enough. Paul isn't arguing here against people who don't believe that Jesus was who he said he was. He's not arguing with people who don't believe that Jesus rose from the dead or is the risen and reigning King of heaven. Paul is arguing with those who say that those two realities put together are simply not enough to bring sinful humanity into right relationship with God. Instead, the ceremonial laws that were established through Moses and through the books of Deuteronomy need to be obeyed. The laws need to be followed. Christians are Jews, they argue, and Jews are a people marked by circumcision. Therefore, ipso facto, Christians need to be a people marked by circumcision. And by all regards, Paul is the last person you would think would be making this argument. Earlier in his letter, he points out that he's one of the circumcised, and not only that, he's the chief among them. Circumcised on the eighth day according to the law, in the right way, at the right time, Paul is one of them. And so you'd think that if Paul is making the progressive argument, that what he'd argue for was a kind of compromise, some tolerable middle ground between two extreme positions. That circumcision might be okay for new babies brought into the community of faith, but maybe those who are converted don't need to undergo this practice. The nature of politics, the nature of debate in the church is that human dialogue always wants to move as slowly as possible. That's the natural state of it. But what's natural is seldom what's right. Sometimes the needle needs to spike. Sometimes the compromise needs to be abandoned in pursuit of a deeper truth and a greater reality. Sometimes the leap that needs to be taken is a leap of faith. Because Paul recognizes that motion is always oriented towards mission. He sees the trajectory that God is on, and he pushes and he pushes and he pushes the church to move in the same direction, to catch up to where God is already working. He looks and he sees men and women and children coming to a faith and a trust in the risen and the reigning Lord, in the risen and the reigning Christ, in huge numbers. He sees them coming to faith in greater numbers than they are in the Jewish communities where Christianity started. And he puts two and two together that soon Christianity will be more Gentile than it is Jewish. Soon this conversation will be settled in a different way. But the question that was rolling around in the back of Paul's mind, I think, is how much time and how much energy are we going to waste having a conversation that has already been decided by demographics? And history proved Paul right. When the Bible was compiled some 300 years after this letter was written, this letter was included because the compilers saw Paul's grasp of grace and his forward-thinking perspective. The message that Paul wants the church to hear is don't waste time on discussions today that are going to be settled tomorrow. There will always be times for, there will always be conversations that the church will have to have where compromise will be required. But when the church seeks to follow its God in mission, and that mission challenges us to leap forward by bounds that seem unclear, that seem frightening, there is a time for leaping and bounding too. There are times where the church needs to spike the needle. And Paul's message challenges us. Do not hold back from the direction that God is calling you to for fear of the people that God has placed around you. No person gets to hold the church for ransom. It doesn't matter whether you're the minister, an elder. It doesn't matter what your last name is or how long you've been here for. as St. Andrew's moves into a time of intentional mission, a time of discernment, a time of unpacking and figuring out where God is calling us to go as a church, Paul's hope and Paul's prayer for us is that if we are seeking after God, God is going to call us to move forward, sometimes by compromise and sometimes by leaps and bounds and sometimes by spiking the needle, but always moving forward. And we're doing it together. If you've ever been whitewater rafting, I think it's a perfect analogy for the church. Because here's a group of men and women and children who are careening down a river that by every conceivable metric is actively trying to kill you. The water is frigid. It moves at a breakneck pace. There are jagged rocks that jut out of the water seemingly at random. There are sticks that hang, there are branches that hang low and are broken. There are sticks that are floating and jammed themselves. And here is a group of frightened people huddled together on a fragile boat, throwing themselves into the thick of it. But they do it not alone. They felt it prudent, whether they felt it prudent or whether they thought it was beneficial or whether they thought it was just smart planning, they hired a guide who was trained in the art and the science of rafting, who had dedicated years of life to the sport, who was committed to walking up and down the trail that the river runs every single day, learning to read each curve before it comes, knowing where there were new branches, knowing where there were new rocks. But the guide's job is not to paddle. The guide's job is to sit in the middle of the raft and give out directions. If anyone on the craft doesn't listen, everyone on the craft is in trouble. It's the same with the church. We're only effective when we're doing the work that we're called to do together. It's my job and it's Jan's job to chart the course and to know the terrain, to walk the riverbank ahead of you each and every week, but to trust that your commitment to us was to pick up your paddles and listen. You are the ones who have to paddle together because there's too much at stake not to. So as a church, as we enter into a year of discernment together, locally and nationally, as we have theological conversations with each other that are difficult at times, as we seek to read the Bible together and discern and understand it together, as we search for the person that God has in store for us as our third minister, we have to be on the same page. And so here at the end of Paul's letter to the church in Galatia, in the great testimony to the church in motion, Paul gives us four criteria for making sure that we are all on the same page. Is my attention squarely on the cross of Christ? In other words, am I recognizing my own brokenness, my own limitations, my own fears, my own insecurities, and listening for Christ's call to pick up my cross and leave it all behind and follow him up my own personal Golgotha? Secondly, are the world's ways of thinking about things firmly behind me? In other words, is my approach about me having control, which is the way the world says to make decisions, or about God having control, the way God says to make decisions? Thirdly, am I adding anything to this conversation that is not essential? In other words, is what I'm doing getting in the way of connecting people to the gospel of Jesus Christ? And fourthly, will this bring us closer to the new creation that God has promised us? In other words, how important is this issue to the mission of the church? And so the church is equipped for mission, for moving forward together. But I hear the fears. I hear the complaints. I hear the anxieties. The church is moving faster and further down this river than many of us would prefer. The movement is inevitable, though. Our job is to be faithful to the one who is the still point in the turning universe, the one who is bigger, that who holds galaxies in the palm of his hand, the one who promises that he will be the same yesterday, today, and forever. And so, something snuck in here while we weren't paying attention. This morning, as the church gathered in worship, Jesus was present with us. The Holy Spirit fell on God's people. And this morning, he makes himself, his presence known through the gifts of bread and wine, may we always remember the never-ending faithfulness, the unchanging, boundless grace of God as he invites us to come to the table. Come, drink from a cup that will never run dry. Come, eat, and never be hungry again. The table is open to those who know Christ this morning, to those who want to know him more this morning. And so I declare to you that this is not a Presbyterian table today, nor is this St. Andrew's table, nor is it a Calgarian or a Canadian table. This is the table that belongs to the one who holds the universe in the palm of his hand, the same yesterday, today, and forever.